Please join me in welcoming today's security panel.
Thank you, Chris. I'm going to deviate just a moment here. As I was sitting up here listening to Chris talk, the thing that came into my mind was the flag that was sitting behind us. So I would ask that you all stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. And when we say it, remember what we are talking about. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. In every generation, there's an event that can be considered transformative. Some have effects that last much longer than that generation. September 11, 2001 was such an event. As we approach the 7th anniversary of this horrific tragedy, it is important not only to reflect back and honor those who lost their lives, but to continue to learn from this unfortunate event, as our country has done so many times in the past. We cannot passively sit on the sidelines and say that someone else should handle this. Each of us needs to take an active role in making our community safer. As Ronald Reagan once said, we are only one generation from losing our freedom. We cannot and will not let that happen. So today we're taking a page out of Ronald Reagan's playbook and providing leadership in the community to elevate the discussions on security and preparedness in some areas that you might not think about. We are proud to partner with CLU because this is not only good business, it's the right thing to do. As a high-profile site, we take security and preparedness very seriously here at the library. The potential symbolism of a strike is never far out of our minds. Make no mistake about it, symbolism is as powerful as the act of violence itself by those who perpetrate these indefensible crimes. Being prepared is not an option, it is essential. Terrorists know that they cannot compete with our country's strength, so they look to have the biggest impact possible, thereby following the classic definition of terrorism: the use of force or threats to demoralize and intimidate, causing terror or intense fear to those involved. It should be noted, though, while the bad guys cannot compete with our strength, I'm reminded when our forefathers and foremothers declared independence, it was against the most powerful country in the world, and they won. Therefore, we must always remain vigilant. History is a very important teacher, but along with the lessons of the past, there needs to be a proactive approach to addressing the issues of today, as well as for the future. A vast majority of our security and preparedness plan here at the library, you should never see. But that doesn't mean we sit idle, nor should anyone else. Working in conjunction with local, state, and federal law enforcement, we are constantly keeping watch and training. As a matter of fact, just Monday, we had our regular fire drill. And guess what? We didn't pass. We learned things, and now we're trying to fix those. With our active Center for Public Affairs programming, we quite often have high-profile guests: presidents, heads of states, ambassadors, Supreme Court justices, governors, etc. Each one presenting a particular concerns as it relates to security. We work closely with all levels of law enforcement to ensure clear and effective communication. One of the highest profile events was that of President Reagan's funeral. That required some 8 different agencies all working together for the common good. That is what we should all strive for, working together for a common purpose with clear communication. Today, with you, we are beginning to meet those 3 objectives. Our goal is to have an important dialogue on a very important issue and impart experience, knowledge, and know-how to serve the common good. Now, what I'd like to do is introduce Steve Chelander, who will start off the panel. Steve?
You can from here.
Yeah.
Good morning. As was mentioned, I am a board member of the National Transportation Safety Board, and I was appointed by President Bush in 2006, and confirmed by the United States Senate in December of 06 and sworn in January of 07. In that position, I'm one of five board members appointed by the President to sit at the top of Mount NTSB, if you will, and govern that agency. What we do is, in the NTSB, is we investigate accidents, all aviation accidents. We're mandated by Congress to do that, and selected other modes of transportation as well, and find out probable cause, findings and conclusions, all those kind of things, but make recommendations, more importantly, to hopefully alleviate those types of accidents from happening in the future. But one of the things that is prevalent with what we do is security. It is kind of a, you know, we're a safety board, but we are also looking at security. We work hand in hand when we go to aviation accidents, for instance, with the FBI. The FBI is on scene every time we show up at a major accident, a railroad accident, a marine safety accident. The FBI is there. And we go in first. We take a look at the scene. And if we see that there's anything that might be of security, have a security implication, then we bring the FBI in. They take primacy in the accident investigation and take over. But we're constantly working with agencies like the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and so forth, as we look at safety of the traveling public. Now, before I was with the National Transportation Safety Board, which was mentioned earlier, I was a pilot with American Airlines. And I was a captain with American Airlines on the day that September 11th took place. And as you know, two of our airplanes, American Airlines, were involved in that day. So it hit pretty close to home to all of us that were at American Airlines. We lost comrades that day, but more importantly, we lost a lot of citizens in New York, and we actually hurt our nation very badly. But from that, I think we've changed who we are. There's been a lot of changes. I saw them taking place at American Airlines almost immediately after September 11th. On September 12th, we started changing in the airline industry across the board. A lot of things that you, the traveling public, me, the traveling public, were unaware of. But things that were necessary that we should have been doing actually before September 11th. Things of, for instance, I'll give you some for instances of things that are taking place in security with the airlines, but all the cockpit doors that are between the passengers and the pilots, they're now reinforced doors. They've got electronic coded locks. You can't get in those doors. They're bulletproof. They're crash-proof. And so forth, so you can't get in. Because as I think everyone knows, on September 11th, that was the one issue that caused those four airplanes to go down, and that was the breach of the cockpit. And you can't breach a cockpit today unless they want you to come in. So we have bulletproof doors, we have reinforced doors, we have coated doors in the cockpits. We also have security checks of all the aircraft every day. Every day before an airplane flies, it has to go through a complete inspection. This is pretty cost prohibitive to the airlines, but they have to do it. They check every airplane every day before it flies, and it has to be signed off by several security agents that it's been done by the airline every day. And as the first captain, I did this several times, but when you show up in the morning, you're the first captain to fly that day, you've got to review that paperwork to ensure that you've had that cabin security taken on that airplane. You also have, and sometimes you can even see this as the traveling public, you go into a lavatory and you'll see little security tape across a lot of the little openings where you can open doors under a sink or you can open a door that's got storage stuff in it. You'll see a little security tape across there. That's placed on there every single morning, and it's got to be sealed or you can't accept that airplane. And passengers, you know, how much of a pain is it to go through security now and have to have your little one quart plastic bag with your little 3-ounce liquids and gels and so forth. That's all out of necessity. That's the threat. I'd groan about it every time I have to go through security, and yes, I still have to go through security, and I carry a badge now, you know, and I still have to go through it. I still have to comply with the 3-ounce bottles and so forth. I just gave up and started buying things when I got to the hotel. But that's all necessary. That's all part of the security. And TSA is now a new organization within the United States government. Before, the airlines would contract with security agencies wherever they were located, whether it's Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles. They had local security agencies that the airlines would contract with, and they were, you know, running the magnetometers and so forth. But after September 11th, that became a government agency. And it's now under the Department of Homeland Security, and the TSA mans that with uniformed personnel with badges on their chest. And they are constantly improving what they're doing. You know, we're looking at what's going to happen in the future. I think we're going to talk about that a little bit today. But there's better and better equipment every day. They've now they're allowing you to leave your laptops in a case and run them through the security before you had to take your laptop computer out and put it in a separate bin and run it through. So things are getting better. They're getting more efficient. They have explosive checkers now that they can check explosives in baggage that's loaded on airplanes. That's becoming more and more prevalent till eventually it will be 100% check. So on and on the story goes on how well we do. But I think what's most important, and I'll leave it at this because I know I've got to stop in 5 minutes. But I think what's most important and what we've changed most in our country is the way you and me and everybody else that's out there traveling around, the way we act. And my fear is that we are getting further and further away. It's 7 years now since this happened. Coming up the anniversary, we're starting to forget, we're starting to put that in the back of our mind, and we're becoming less vigilant. Because our vigilance and paying attention to what's going on a day-to-day basis as we fly around or as we ride on trains and so forth, paying attention to what's going on will never allow that to happen again. And I firmly believe that it won't happen again because we as citizens of this country won't let it happen again. We had our guard down, and we allowed that to happen on September 11th, but we cannot afford to let that happen again. So constant vigilance on our parts as citizens of this country is an important security aspect. I'll stop my comments at that point because I think I've hit my 5 minutes, but I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you, Steve. David?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Cal Lutheran and the library here for the opportunity to be here. Security is key to all of us. If you think about it, we would say everybody's concerned about security. Are we concerned about the same things? Probably not. To a large extent, it depends on the experiences we have. One of the things that our organization does is we do training and exercises across the country, and now we're doing some things overseas. Everywhere we go, there is a concern about security at some level, and to some extent, your concern is based on the knowledge that you have. So when one questions and says, well, gee, are we better off than we were before? Well, yeah, we probably are. Unfortunately, we know more. And so now then you're aware of threats that are out there that in the late 90s you may not have thought about, so you felt safe. Well, we've dealt with threats, and we're going to continue to deal with threats. But one of the problems that we find as we go around the country, especially here in the U.S., is that we have a very short attention span. You know, with all due respect, Sheriff Brooks is not Kiefer Sutherland. He cannot solve the problem in 24 hours. You know, we have a tendency to believe that we see it on television, he can do it. And as good as Bob is, he can't make it happen. And as good as Greg is as district attorney, he's not as good as James Woods, who can do the whole investigation, go to trial, and win in 44 minutes, 60 if you count commercials.
We're working on it.
But yeah, and so we believe that if we increase the salary, you know, 10%, he'll be able to do that. Unfortunately, we'll decrease his staff to offset the 10%, so he'll do it himself. Or if we look at it and say, gee, we're looking at a fairness issue, and we take football, for instance. We watch football, and we say there's a very finite set of rules. So we all say, okay, we're going to have this war on terrorism, and we're going to do a set of rules. Well, you can imagine if you had one football team out there with a set of rules, the other one's out there with guns, knives, and pipes. Well, you know, and that's kind of where we are, because we're dealing in many cases with people who are not under the law, the Geneva Convention. We're dealing with people who aren't even a country. We're dealing with people that we can't even have a peace treaty with because we don't know who they are. And yet we continue under a set of rules because that's who we are. And that's what makes it interesting for the world that I live in, is that how do you prepare people? How do you make them aware? How do you help them be ready to meet the threat at the same time we live in a rule-based society? And so that's the challenge that we have. We look at what we've done since 9/11, and we've had a really great summary here, and as one who's flown 120,000 miles already this year, anything that helps me get through security faster is good. If you look at it, we put together Department of Homeland Security. Now, some of us are just frustrated with it. Some of you in the business side say, what a waste of time. But we are moving ahead. It makes a difference. A lot of money and technology nowadays that helps us. Training, exercises. I find it pretty exciting when we put on an exercise here in Ventura County, 40 different activities come together and work. That's pretty phenomenal. Because when you think about it, at the macro level, when the U.S. military goes to the war, there's four agencies. We do 42, and they don't all work for the same boss. And that, you think about that, especially in DOD, one of the things we find fascinating is, with all due respect, you know, Captain Connors over here from Naval Base Ventura County, he works for the president. Well, it turns out Bob Brooks doesn't. And so now then, they've got to come together and work together, and they don't have a single boss. Well, then you add all these other agencies in there, and it becomes kind of a fascinating management problem. And what's really interesting is see the efforts that these individual organizations have made to come together. And so when we put on our exercises, when we do our training, we see the people coming together to fight the common goal, regardless of what agency they're from. And then we say, what are the threats that are out there today? I classify threats in four levels. This is Dave Banks. Nobody else will agree, but for the moment, since I'm speaking, these are the four threats. You have international terrorists. We all know Al-Qaeda. We look for the guys that look like they're a little bit different than the rest of us, and so they're threats. Unfortunately, we have domestic terrorists like Timothy McVeigh. They look just like us. Then you have nuts. This is the category that's not terribly academic. But this is the guy who's sitting in the trunk of a car with a rifle picking off people. 5 deaths on the East Coast, nearly shut down the school system in Northern Virginia. Pretty broad thing. And then you have Mother Nature. We don't like to think of Mother Nature as a terrorist, but if you look at the events, I can go over here to the tower in Oxnard and blow that sucker up and it falls down, or I could have a major earthquake and it falls down. You know, right after it happens, it's kind of the same problem. And so we have to look at it. So we say, well, what do we do? Well, I think what we do is we prepare for the incident. We become aware of the antecedent causes so that we're better. Throw out you an idea. Can you imagine for a moment, and I was sharing this earlier, Friday after Thanksgiving. Now, those of you who are these people who get up at 5 o'clock and go to the malls, you kind of know what it looks like. But 9 o'clock, the mall is full. Now, in your mind, envision a young man with a, you know, sweatshirt, hood on, baggy pants, loose jacket, walks into the mall and decides to blow himself up. Now, those of you who are businessmen would understand is economically you have really impacted the Christmas season, because everybody's going to believe that the mall they're going to go to, there's going to be another bomber. And so it doesn't take a whole lot. And you say, well, wow, what if, you know, who wants to die for this stuff? Well, let's take the next picture. A young man in his 25, you know, who just dressed like an average one with a toddler by their hand and a box of, you know, a bag of Christmas presents, sets them on a bench in the mall. We'll use over here at the Oaks Mall. Sets them on the bench, turns to the person next to him and says, could you watch these for a minute? I need to take my child to the toilet. And then the bomb goes off. And he didn't have to die to do it. So we say, wow, how do you protect against that? That's pretty hard. But we can be aware. We can be looking for those kinds of things. And then we can look at the training that's necessary so that when the first responders come from all these agencies, then we don't set off the second bomb. Those are the kinds of things we do with training exercises. Are we safer? What I find fascinating, in 1990 we fought Gulf One, you know, fought the war over in the Middle East, and that was under Republican administration. And under the Democratic administration that followed, we said, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff that wasn't destroyed, chemical and biological weapons. You know, there's a lot in the mid-90s, a lot of press on where are all these things. And then under the next Republican administration, they said, we're going to go find them, and we didn't find them. And so now then we've decided that since we didn't find them under the Republicans, they don't exist. What's fascinating is we really believe that they were there. We didn't find a new way to make them, but we didn't find out where the ones went that we didn't find. So, you know, you sit around and you're safer. It's whether or not you believe that there was anything out there. And you can hide a 50-gallon barrel in a lot of places. Even with Bob's people, I bet I could hide a 50-gallon barrel somewhere that he couldn't find. So there's a lot out there, so we have to be vigilant. What do we do as a group here? I think, first of all, we understand that it cost. It cost us to have a capability. I have a very close young couple that lives with us. Yeah, she's 33 years old. She's against the war in Iraq. She doesn't understand why we do it. She doesn't share there's really terrorism. And I said, okay, if you're willing to give up 10 airliners a year, we could probably save the money we spend in Iraq. Are you willing to make that trade-off? Well, the United States, especially if I'm on it, I'm really not willing to make that trade-off. And so that's what we're up against. We have to make the trade-off. We really want Bob and the organizations to work together. We want them to train, but we don't want to increase their budget. We don't want to pay for that extra preparedness. And so what happens is we ask people to do more with less, and they do an incredible job. And I think anytime you see any of your public sector people, you need to thank them for the dedication that they have. And those of you in the private sector need to be looking at how you can help. How can you help? Really briefly, in case the question doesn't come later. You need to be able to say, are your people prepared? Because if we basically assume that public services are available. If public services aren't available, what are you going to do? If you have an accident, if it's your facility and there are no ambulances, what would you do? We assume ambulances will be there. If all at once a million people and feel like they need to leave San Fernando Valley, where are they going to go? Up the 5, up 101. Ventura County's in gridlock. So are you prepared for that to occur? And I think that's your challenge as business people to say, am I prepared on my part to support the public people?
Thank you. Now what we're going to do... what we're going to do now is, that was kind of the macro. Now we're going to bring it down to an area that we might not think of normally when it comes to security and preparedness. Greg?
Thank you, Duke. And I want to join the other panelists in thanking Cal Lutheran University and the Reagan Library for hosting this important event. The type of terrorism that I'd like to talk about doesn't involve religious zealotry. It doesn't involve thoughts of nationalism or geopolitical philosophy. But it is a type of terrorism that for any large employers, large organizations, companies, corporations in the audience this morning, it is a type of terrorism that I can almost certainly guarantee you affects the employees in your businesses and organizations on a regular and routine basis, and that's domestic violence. It's conventional information. The best statistics we have tell us that about 1 million individuals in this nation on an annual basis report being victims of domestic violence. Mind you, it is the most unreported crime there is, or underreported crime. Also, recent surveys by a business alliance to end domestic violence reports that 21% of your full-time employees have at one time or another been victims of domestic violence. 64% of the victims of domestic violence report that it affects their productivity on a regular basis at the job site. So not only is it having an impact upon these employees from the standpoint of their safety, it's affecting their ability to produce your products, provide your services, and the organizations that you operate. And very conservative estimates are that it's the lost productivity due to domestic violence alone reaches somewhere around $750 million annually. And that's probably unduly conservative when you consider all of the other issues that may be involved, like lost time at work and things of those sort. Also, perpetrators. 75% of the people who commit the crime of domestic violence use your resources. They use your computers. They use your telephones. They use the mobile phones that you provide them. They use other devices that employers provide them to threaten, to harass, to intimidate their victims. And we know that the second leading cause of death among women on the workplace is homicide. And a not insignificant number of those homicides are committed by intimates. So I've given you the bad news. Let me give you some takeaways. Let me give you some things as employers that you can do to try to address this problem in the workplace in a realistic way. First of all, I can tell you, having looked at this problem for literally decades, the only way we're ever going to deal with domestic violence effectively is if we deal with it from the top. It takes leadership in the corporation, leadership in the organization. It has to come from the top to address it effectively. One of the key recommendations is to establish, if you're a large enough employer, establish a multidisciplinary response team. Do that before you establish policies. This multidisciplinary response team would consist of people that are at the executive level in your organization, HR individuals, if you have medical staff, if you have legal staff, communications staff, and any employee assistance program staff that you have, so that you've got a group of professionals that you have separately trained in this dynamic of domestic violence that understand it and understand how to respond to it, and are equipped to provide victims when it's reported or discovered in the workplace, are equipped to provide those victims with information and resources. The employer shouldn't try to put themselves in the position of being a counselor or a therapist or dealing with the problem directly, but rather use the myriad of resources that are already in place in our community to get that victim of domestic violence help. We know that when it's reported and when the criminal justice system gets involved, when law enforcement investigates, when it's brought to our office for prosecution, that's part of the beginning of dealing with the problem and trying to break that cycle of violence. So employers need to have teams that are trained to deal with this in an up-close and personal way. Another key aspect of this is dealing with security. You know, all of us have become much more conscious about things like full entry screening, much more conscious about things involving security. When we have employees who are at risk, who we know have been victimized in the past, we need to take appropriate steps in the workplace to alert other employees about this possible risk so that precautions can be taken. We need to screen our employees. We need to do backgrounds before we hire people to prevent a lot of this. Training is critical. Training can't just be done at the multidisciplinary response team level or at the executive level. It's got to be done for all employees because a lot of the reports about domestic violence don't come from the victims themselves. They come from coworkers, friends, family members of the victims. So to the extent that you train your organization, that you train your staff in noticing the signs of domestic violence and what to do when someone reports to them that they've been a victim, you're going to be more effective at protecting that workplace. The linkages are key. We have many organizations in this county that are uniquely equipped. We have battered women's shelters that are operated by Interface and the Coalition to End Family Violence. In the district attorney's office, we can assist you with employees in taking them through the process of obtaining restraining orders that will restrain perpetrators not only from preying upon the victim in the home and out in the community, but even coming to your workplace. And we provide that service free of charge, and we're a resource for you in that regard. We also have a family violence prevention and education center that we operate on a weekly basis. Each week we conduct a course in Spanish and a course in English for victims or friends of victims of domestic violence that teaches them about the dynamics of the cycle of violence, gives them kind of a tool set of things that they can do to stop that cycle of violence and deal with it. It's been a great program for us. We think it's had a preventative role here in the county. We also have, through the assistance of some corporate sponsors, we provide victims of terrorist stalking and things of that sort with 911 cell phones, where they can dial 911 free of charge at any time. And then finally, through the Coalition to End Family Violence, we actually have volunteer lawyers that will come in. Most victims of domestic violence have family law issues. They may have child custody issues. They may have support and housing issues. They can come to us, and we hook them up with volunteers from the Ventura County Bar Association that will provide them legal advice and counsel at no charge to assist them in getting through that process. So this is just some basic takeaways from this that I would encourage all employers to take a serious look at. This is one of our most significant workplace problems.
Thank you, Greg. I think it was shortly after 9/11 that the term first responder was coming to the vernacular of the public, in particular the media. Representing the first responders on our panelists today is Sheriff Bob Brooks.
Well, good morning. I'm feeling a little inferior after these presentations and after David pointed out that unlike Keith or Sutherland, I can't solve a domestic crisis or international incident in 24 hours. And even being in law enforcement, reflecting on that, I haven't even spent as much time in jail as he has. He must be doing something right. When I started in patrol in the city of Thousand Oaks in 1975, life was pretty simple for a street cop. We had garden variety crime, mostly property crime. Real excitement happened if an animal got loose from the old jungle land compound, and you could find a hippo in the bottom of a pool or an alligator crossing Thousand Oaks Boulevard or the sighting of a mythical panther, and life got good. We were in the aftermath of the L.A. riots. We still had terrorist groups like the Weathermen and the SLA, and they were still running around occasionally attacking police stations. But life was pretty calm, and life was the same as it had been for decades and generations in law enforcement for the most part. Now all of a sudden we're participating in joint terrorism task forces and early warning groups and fusion centers, and law enforcement officers are traveling the globe, learning everything that they can about military and intelligence and terrorist units. And I've had opportunities to take some of those trips as well, and it's eye-opening. But as I was driving by the New Oaks Mall, which is beautiful if you haven't seen it, really a showpiece for the city of Thousand Oaks, I reflected on a trip to Israel that I took just a few months ago. And we went to the Azrael Mall, which is an enclosed mall in the city of Jerusalem. It has never had a successful terrorist attack, while there have been plenty of other terrorist attacks in retail areas in the city. And as we toured the building, we found out that they spend 26% of their gross budget on security. Imagine that, those of you who run businesses. When you pull into the parking lot, every vehicle is searched, trunks are popped, mirrors underneath, explosive sniffers, dogs. When you get into the parking lot, there are armed patrols with automatic weapons. Every 100 feet along the perimeter, there's a plainclothes former military guard, automatic weapons again, flak jackets. When you get to the door, there are metal detectors, there are dogs, there are bag searches, there are plenty of patrols on the inside. Every retail establishment has to have a security permit issued by the police, and the police have to approve your security plan, come out and inspect it regularly, train with you on a regular basis. In that mall alone, they train 100 times a month in conjunction with the police and sometimes with military. They've deterred several attacks, and the place is full. It's vibrant. They're making a profit because people feel safe there. And one of the things when you look at with Israel is they've undergone 60 years of terrorism. It's not new for them. That's why we went there to look and see how they dealt with issues. They're used to it. They're a resilient population. It's a fact of life for them, and they learn to go on, and they learn to make reasonable accommodations. So the question for us in America is that our future? Well, hopefully not. Are we going to have to take those extreme measures? Hopefully that never hits our shores. But they've done what they had to do to survive, to prevent and deter, which is really the first mission when we're dealing with those kind of threats. So as local business people and people that run educational institutions, we've done training with CLU, for example, on dealing with school violence in the aftermath of the University of West Virginia incident. How prepared are we? For your business, do you have a security plan not only to deal with crime and loss prevention? Are you prepared to shelter in place if there's the kind of incident or attack where your employees can't leave, nobody can get to them, and traffic is blocked? As David mentioned, one of our routine scenarios is looking at a major event of any kind in LA where 1 to 2 million people will try to go northbound on 101. Well, nobody can get to you, and you can't leave. Do you have food? Do you have supplies? What do you do if there's no power and you don't have communication? How do you protect your records? All of those things that you have to think of. Security planning is something that everyone should do for their home and for their business. And the second thing you take a look at is what is the impact of an event after it transpires. I was in New Orleans after Katrina. They didn't have mail for a year. Their banks just ceased to exist along with most of the records that are contained in those banks. How do you sustain your personal life? How do you sustain a business? The city still has interrupted water and power every day, 3 years after the fact. Most businesses failed. Very few successfully relocated. And so when you take a look at the impact of all of those things, you know, we recently had Hurricane Gustav come through, and we saw a completely different scenario. What has changed over the course of, really since 9/11, federal, state, and local governments work together. They know each other. A number of years ago, we had Alaska Air 261 crash. That was our first involvement with NTSB. It worked, even though we had different systems, different priorities, different chains of command, because the people made it work. They knew each other in most cases. They trust each other. They got by all the communication barriers, and they made it work. It wasn't what it should be. Is it better today? It's a whole lot better today. Communication at every level, from the military to federal and state law enforcement, local, fire, public health, is much more cooperative. We're a lot better prepared. But when you look at Katrina being a disaster, and you look at Gustav being not as bad, but certainly a much more survivable and effective evacuation, a coordinated plan, the differences were a level of commitment at every level of government, including the private sector, a level of preparation that wasn't there at all after when Katrina hit, but certainly was when Gustav hit, and a level of cooperation that was forced by all the public criticism, all the attention on the failure of Katrina and the local response in that instance. So as business people, what's your continuity plan? If something like that happened, for us, the most likely thing would be a catastrophic earthquake in Southern California, where your main arteries wouldn't be available to you. It would take, and one thing that we've learned, 72 hours isn't close to what you need. You need a lot more of that for survivability. As a business, you may need a continuity plan that carries you completely out of the area. Do you have a plan to relocate? If your key decision maker is not available, who's going to make the decisions? If your employees either can't get to work or can't leave work, are you going to be capable of taking care of them for a period of time until help can come with you? If there's interruption of food and water and medical supplies, are you capable of dealing with that? How do you protect your records? How do you deal with backup vendors if your vendors aren't available? How do you protect your customers and your employees in any case? And do you have a plan? And do you train in that plan? Do your employees understand it? Can they respond to it? Are the materials you need to refer to readily accessible for you so that if the unexpected happens, and it will be unexpected, we don't have hurricanes in California, we're going to be surprised by what hits us. Can not only you and your family, but also your business survive, your school survive, and not only weather the storm, but thrive when it's all over. So as we take a look at all the things that have happened, we're a better country, we're a better prepared country, but the one thing that we've learned is government can't do it all for you. There isn't enough. There's not enough government resource to respond immediately to anything of that catastrophic size. It's going to take a long time. This is a country that was built on a pioneer spirit and personal responsibility, and that's still what's going to carry us through. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. You've heard that threats come in all shapes and sizes from all areas. I'm going to ask a question to a couple of the panelists, and then I'll open it up for a few questions out in the audience. Sheriff, you mentioned, the Israeli mall and that balance that we're looking at. Before you answer, I would like this address to Steve, is what is the balance between individual liberty and heightened security? And as a member of the NTSB, how can we reduce that, the friction that happens when that balance and the necessity of having security?
You know, that's a great question. I'm listening to the other panelists, and I was especially interested in hearing about Israel and their preparedness, and the citizens of that country, and out of necessity, have given up a lot of those individual liberties out of necessity, because they have to, because they're under attack constantly.
But we're not, though.
And we're not. And that's the other side of it. We've also all, I think all of us have said in one way or another that it's our vigilance that's going to be the next security stopgap for what's getting ready to happen or what may happen. And I think we like our life, especially here in California. We like our cushy life. We like, driving around in our nice cars and living in our, not so expensive homes now. We enjoy a nice lifestyle, and we don't want to give that up. And we haven't been touched by it here like people in other parts of the country. You take Washington, D.C., where I come from, a lot of those individual liberties have been given up in that town.
Is it working?
And it's working. I mean, you don't move around as freely as we used to in Washington, D.C. I arranged a tour, a White House tour, for some friends just 2 weeks ago. And I was amazed at what I had to go through to get these people to just go through a public tour and see the White House, the People's House. Whereas when I was at the White House working there, and that's another sidelight that I'd just kind of like to touch on just a second, is in my past life, I was military aide to President Reagan. And I worked in the White House, and I used to arrange those tours, and I used to see the public tours happen every day. Well, it doesn't happen anymore like that. You've got to put your name into a bank and be looked at from all different directions by the FBI and the Secret Service and so forth just to say whether or not you can come in through the White House, the People's House. So in Washington, you don't travel as freely. Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House on the north side is closed. Pedestrian traffic only. You can't drive by there anymore. Used to when I was there, you could drive right in front of the White House. But you can't do that anymore. So we've had to give up some of those individual liberties for security. A lot of it is transparent. You don't see it. But it is something that we do have to give up. Now, I'm just like the rest of us. I like to move freely. I like my lifestyle and so forth. But I also realize that I want to be protected. Now, I observe firsthand the protection of the President of the United States, the Secret Service, and how they protected him. I had a role in that because I was a military aide, and I was the emergency actions officer for the President and so forth. And it dawned on me as we were all talking here, I'm thinking, now that was the ultimate in security. You could not get near that guy. the President of the United States, after 1981 in particular. 1981 was when the President was shot. But after that, you didn't get near him. Security was and is very tight for him. And I thought, well, how do you do that for all the citizens of this country, the 300 million people that live in America? Well, you don't do that. It would be cost prohibitive, as was pointed out earlier. So it's incumbent upon us as individuals to be the security force that's going to stop the next threat. But I think we have to give up some of our own individual liberties personally to do that. That's a tough call, and it's a tough balance to make.
I didn't want to give you an easy question.
No, well, that's not an easy question, but it's a very pertinent question to what we're talking about here, because we do have to give up some if we want to live like we live.
Sheriff, can we achieve that balance?
Well, I think there's been a lot of attention to it, and it's not that it's been something that hasn't been considered important. And every time you have an event, even a local event, you have people crying for some pretty restrictive measures that really infringe on liberties to a point that we're sensitive. It's usually law enforcement that's saying, you know, we don't need all that yet. And you know, we want only, just like as a business owner, you only want to spend on security what you need to. We only want to inconvenience the public and infringe on liberty as much as absolutely have to. So it's always being guarded against. And the American public are their thermometer on that. When they start to complain, then you know you probably have gone a little far. And all of a sudden, liberty and safety are coming into conflict, and we always want to avoid that.
David, you know, from the global perspective, you know, that's what gets the headlines. And the headlines is what drives a lot of the conversation on our dinner at our dining room tables for dinner. Do you think the media is helping or hurting the cause of our nation's security?
I'm glad you gave that question to him.
I did that on purpose, Greg. He doesn't have to run for office.
It's a fascinating question. That's the first academic answer, and then I guess I'll give a political answer. There's two sides to the sword. One is publishing what we're doing is, in fact, a deterrent for some people. Because if Sheriff Brooks leaks to the press that he has a widget or training that deters a certain thing, the probability of that thing occurring goes down, because the guy who has it will try something else. So in that case, the media, I think, does help. I think that where the media can hurt, one of the things we find when we run our exercises is that usually we'll have a press event afterwards, and because I'm the head of the organization and I'm from out of town, the press usually asks the question. And one of the first questions they ask is, who screwed up? That's exactly what they want to know, because that's a newspaper article. That attitude, you know, doesn't make the public servants feel better. It doesn't build the teamwork. And so then I think that kind of hurts. You know, I'm not looking for the press to go out and whitewash everything, but I think we need to collectively also be reminded of how good we have it. That when we run an exercise here in Ventura County or Los Angeles or in Portland, Maine, we have an awful lot of dedicated people who come together, and they should be encouraged. And encouraged to the point where when you find a problem, it helps get the resources to solve it. Right now, Sheriff Brooks knows there's things he could do better, but he can't afford to have it published. Because on the one hand, if people knew, part of them would vote to raise the taxes to give him the resources he needs to do better. The other one would use the same information to beat him up and saying he's not a very good sheriff and he ought to be voted out of office. And so it becomes a tough path for media. The more information you give, the harder it is, because usually the information is wrong and it's late.
So that too is a balancing act.
Right.
Steve, would you have something to say at the national level?
Along the lines of air travel and the media and what they have said about some things that go on in air travel. For instance, after September 11th, they started a program called the Federal Flight Deck Officer Program, which is armed pilots. Pilots that are flying your airplanes today with American, United, all the airlines are armed. And they go through a very stringent course at their own expense, and they carry guns once the door is closed on an airplane and it's pushed back. They strap it on their hip. Now, that's been publicized. That's been put out in the media that that's taken place. But the media doesn't tell you, and I won't tell you, who's carrying it, because not all pilots are carrying them. For instance, I elected before I left American, before I retired from American, I elected not to be an FFDO. But you didn't know that. When you got on a flight, or the bad guys are going to pick a flight, they don't know which one of those flights those pilots are armed. There's a lot of them out there carrying guns in the cockpit, but you don't know which ones they are. As well, the Federal Air Marshal Program. Before September 11th, there was a Federal Air Marshal Program, and there were air marshals on certain flights, but not very many. After September 11th, the Federal Air Marshal Program blossomed into this huge program. Now there's a lot of air marshals traveling around on airplanes, and that's been publicized by the media. However, you don't know which flights they're on. You don't know which seats they sit in. You don't know who they are. You can try to pick them out, and I do it all the time, trying to pick out who they are. I happen to know which
He's
seats they sit in. So
I got a success rate, though.
But at any rate, that's part of what we want the media to put out there, is that there is this deterrent force. You just can't see it. And we don't want the bad guys to see it. And so there is a good and there is a bad to what the media can put out and how they put it out.
Yeah, I think that's really what it comes down to. There's that word balance again. What right. can we do? And in issues that are difficult like these, there's not always some responsibilities, not only as individuals but as companies, because of that vigilance and that observation. Think about that professor in Florida. He would have been in a neighborhood just like we live in right now, but now he's behind bars because he was one of the bad guys. All right, I'll open it up to questions.
Duke, can I make one comment just because we left the media topic before I could say this? And I am an elected official. I'll say something nice about the media. But I've been sheriff for 10 years. We rely on the support of the individual citizens and the private sector to do almost everything we do, as Greg mentioned. There are terrorist investigations that we've had here in Ventura County have really become because somebody picked up the phone and called and said, there's something unusual. You guys told me to watch for this. I saw it. The only way we have to reach them is the media. And in 10 years, there's never been a time that we didn't need to alert the public about a crime problem, a terrorism potential, natural disaster preparedness, that the media wasn't our greatest ally. So we're not happy about every article. They're there to tell the truth. Sometimes they're under tremendous time pressures. It may not always be completely correct. But in terms of having their heart in the right place and being an ally in this effort, they certainly have been, and we really appreciate the relationship we have with them.
It's great to hear positive comments like that. All right. Yeah. Oh, Liv, please wait. I'm sorry. Wait till you get the microphone because we are taping this.
Thank you. I'm Jim Cathcart. Thank you for what you do on our behalf. It occurred to me as I listened to you that the essence or the fabric of society is trust. And when you describe the scenario in Israel, you know, there's very little trust, an enormous amount of restriction of movement and freedom. We certainly don't want to ever have to reach that level. What, since most businesses are very small businesses and don't have a human resources department and don't have the structure to put all this in place, what can we small, very small business owners do, like a 1, 2, 3, very simple things that we can pass along to those that didn't come to this session this morning?
Sheriff, you want to handle that one?
Yeah, one thing that really can be expanded to any size business that's very helpful to all of you is on the federal government website, ready.gov. It has a business plan, and either can be expanded for the size of the business or restricted if it's a very simple business, but it will hit all the key components that you need to do, at least allow you to think about them and plan it out. It's a great format. I don't think it can be improved on, and it's available to all of you.
And perhaps what I might talk to Chris and CLU about is follow-ups to these, because this is an open dialogue, and I think it's an important dialogue to keep it in the forefront. Perhaps we could follow up and actually have working sessions, whether it's websites or information. We're going to be giving you some takeaways today, but I think it's something that we as a community should take that leadership. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Could you tell me what seats those air markets?
That's the media.
But seriously, it seems as though, and in listening to the comments from the panel, we've actually gotten some of the greatest benefits from things that don't cost very much. Securing air cockpit doors, more effective communication between state and local government on Gustav versus Katrina, and as a reader, student of the 9/11 Commission report, we continue to hear in the media over the last couple of days there are relatively low-cost things we could do to secure industrial plants, power-generating facilities. We don't seem to have a desire to do those. Do you think there are things that could be done at relatively low cost that would circumvent the next threat as opposed to the things that we already know are out there?
David, you want to tackle that one?
Short answer, sure. Low cost is always in the eyes of the beholder. If I have a small plant and I have a very small margin, you know, investing $10,000-$20,000, if I don't believe I really need to do it, that I'm not really a target, could be a difficult argument to make. One of the issues that we run into as far as investment that way is the idea that most people don't think it'll ever happen again, so therefore, when they're making the trade-off in their mind of investment, they don't necessarily say, okay, this is going to occur. They go back into the possibility-probability trade-off. And if I'm a small business, I would say here today, how many of you with a small business truly believe you're going to have a terrorist act on your doorstep? You know, you have a much higher probability of having an earthquake or something like that, or a fire, and so we don't make that known. And under our whole focus on liberty, the problem that we have is mandating that people go put in critical infrastructure protection and incur cost if they don't want to. Realistically, one of the things that I've pushed for some time, but being on the government side, I can't do much about it, and that is that really, if you want to talk about safety on the private sector side, is get the insurance companies involved. If I could go to, this is an idea, somebody might take it to the market and make money. If we had an insurance company that insures a business and says, okay, if you have a business plan and if you participate in annual exercise, I'll reduce your insurance premium by 10%. That would be an incentive then for people to go out and get their stuff together. But there is no incentive. And so if you don't have an incentive and you don't really think it's going to occur, you're not going to invest in the story. And so it's that thing, what are we going to do? What's society going to do? And we're not going to let the government mandate it. Yeah, the end of story. I mean, you can talk around it, and then who's going to enforce it? You know, so those are big issues, because I've talked with large companies, and it's still an issue. How do we say that the cost is worth it when I'm looking on return on shareholder equity?
And again, I think it's that leadership that each and every one of you and your companies and our friends should take. All right, we have time for one more question. The young lady. Wait for the microphone. I'm sorry. Sorry, Todd.
Sorry, with California being earthquake disasters, as a member of the Westlake Disaster Response Team, do you feel that the November Golden Dragon shakeout that's going to be going on from San Diego to Santa Barbara will help get all of us prepared for such a tragedy?
Sheriff?
Yeah, the very reason we do that, it's the Golden Guardian exercise is basically a scenario of a 7.8 earthquake in the Los Angeles basin, which is probably the most likely catastrophic thing that can happen in Southern California. And we know that nature can be a cruel taskmaster. All of the breakdowns of infrastructure will happen as a result of that. Multiple jurisdictions will be involved. You're adding complexity. Now, that may not be what happens. It may be something completely different. It could be a 24 suitcase bomb going off in Valencia. But regardless, we prepare for all hazards. And no matter what the problem is, the fact that we tested it with an earthquake today makes everybody more effective, makes communication smoother, lets our organizations get used to working with each other, lets us think out dynamics that would happen no matter what the threat is. And so the same thing with personal preparedness or business preparedness. Doesn't matter what happens to you, you still need to do the same basic things. So do response agencies. And the fact that we work with our staffs and volunteers on a frequent basis, a regular basis, makes us all much better equipped to respond if there's something that catastrophic hits.
Thank you
for your volunteer service.
All right, we'll take one more quick one.
Seen is the program in the UK where there's virtually a closed circuit camera on just about every corner, and they've been extremely successful mm-hmm. with that in not only terrorist incidents but other crimes. And I'm just interested in the response of the panel or some members of it as to do you think that's in our future, and how do you think the American people would react to that?
Well, I would ask Greg from law enforcement. I mean, as a district attorney.
Well, my limited understanding of how it operates in England, it would meet constitutional scrutiny here in this country as well, because it's done in a public place. Under our constitutional system of laws, you do not have an expectation of privacy for criminal conduct that you commit in a public place. And so I think it would be we now routinely in criminal cases where we, for example, have a robbery in a store or some other violent crime in a store where there is a videotape, we routinely retrieve those videotapes, and believe me, they are powerful evidence in the ultimate criminal prosecution. So I can't speak for the public. I don't know how the public would embrace it, but it would make a difference in terms of making us safer.
And from a operational side, London, with their subway bombings, without cameras, they wouldn't have identified suspects, certainly not as quickly as they did. Israel uses those extensively as well. Even here locally, we're looking at grant funding for expansion of security monitors. You'd be amazed at how many cameras are already out there just because private industry has cameras. Every bank, every gas station, there aren't a lot of things that happen that aren't captured by somebody's camera somewhere. And it's an inexpensive way of providing a heightened level of security. It's a great law enforcement tool, and we're very supportive of expansion.
And I was just going to say, from our NTSB perspective, we have used those cameras that we didn't really know that existed when we're investigating accidents, whether it's a railroad accident, a plane accident, and so forth. The accident that just happened in Spain, where 100 and some odd people were killed in Madrid, Spain, we found. We sent 5 investigators over there because of our agreement with the Spanish government, and we found several video cameras that they had from banks, from a security camera at the airport and so forth, that was, as a matter of fact, probably going to come up with the cause of the accident just because those video cameras were going. And we went and gathered all the tapes up and started looking at them and said, sure enough, there it is. And we saw, you know, that aha moment that we're looking for to determine what happened. So I agree with what you just said, and I think that more of that we can do. And I like what the district attorney just said about constitutional right to have them. You know, that's a very important tool for a lot of aspects, from safety perspective, from security perspective, as well for our population. So, good point.
Let's give a warm round of applause.
Many of you this morning filled out these cards asking essentially what was your level of comfort with your own training, the preparedness and training of your employees and your companies And thanks to our quick calculating staff, we've got the results of what you've said. And by about a ratio of 2-1, you don't feel very prepared. You don't feel that your companies are prepared. You don't feel that your employees are prepared to deal with these kinds of issues, which I think speaks to a couple of things, one of which is what Duke said earlier, that we all need to continue this conversation leading to action, and that what we begin here today should continue in an ongoing way, because clearly there's more work to be done. I think also, as Sheriff Brooks indicated, there is a resource list on preparedness that I believe is going to be available in the lobby on your way out. So for those two-thirds of you in the room that want to learn more, there is at least a start in that process. Finally, I would add that the results that you've said indicate why you're here and also indicate what a great debt we owe to the panelists here this morning in raising our awareness of this topic and seeing what has been done, as well as looking ahead to what more has been done. We have some gifts as a token from the University of our appreciation. As I present those to the panelists, maybe you would recognize them one more time with your applause. Let me invite you to two future events. One is the next in this series of the Corporate Leaders Breakfast, coming up on October 21st, as indicated on the card on your table. We'll be hearing from Dennis Murphy, Vice President at Amgen. That event will be back on the CLU campus in the Lundring Events Center. Also, I would like to invite those of you in the audience to the annual Community Leaders Association auction that will be held on November 8th, also on the CLU campus in the Gilbert Sports and Fitness Center. We have postcards in the lobby describing that event. It would be great to see all of you there. Finally, one last request, as I warned you, please pick up the evaluation cards on your table and fill them out and leave them for us. Thank you all very much for being here, and thank you to all the panelists for this terrific session this morning.